Park Place Meeting, Wednesday afternoon, 18th May 1977. Question and answer meeting.
Well, could you go back to this statement you made about the difficulty with yoga or the possible danger of practicing yoga? You mentioned this morning about that doing yoga or practicing yoga overcharge us, if you like. What is the safeguard to that situation? Because yoga is becoming incredibly popular now, and all sorts of people are interested in it.
May I also add something to that so that it's not repeating the same ground? There are some of us who have already discovered that what you say is true, in that one becomes more sensitive, more upset about things, and one does notice that one reacts more violently against things. So that, to carry on from that, when one is already in the situation that meditation or yoga is having that effect, how does one deal with that?
The basic safeguard, which is the word you used, Michael, is mindfulness. To be well aware of what one is doing and what are the results arising from that doing. Watch very carefully all the reactions that emerge from the brain. The brain is a reactive instrument. Pure mind is not a reactive, but a fully responsive thing. One has to learn by experience. There is no getting away from it. But experience is useless unless we attend to it completely and fully. See the experience in its wholeness, in its fullness. And in trying to see the experience in its fullness, again there will be reactions coming back from the brain. This brain won't stop chattering. That's the great difficulty. You see, and it chatters in accordance with its conditioning, its preconceptions and assumptions and beliefs and ideas and so forth, and the driving power behind all that intellectual aspect is one's own natural urges, which of course evolution has handed on to us, and one's particular desires and inclinations. Those are the things to watch. That's how one grows in self-knowledge. That is to say, in the ways of the self as it is. The ways of one's own being, one's own psychophysical being as it is. And when I say watch, please be very careful not to watch in the sense of being on guard against. This is a great mistake. Never be on guard against, because that is perpetuating a situation of conflict. You are prepared for conflict. You're preparing for conflict. You're going to be against something. No, don't be against anything whatsoever. Let it come. How often have I said, the psyche is unkillable. As long as this organism, this physical body is alive, the psyche cannot be killed. It can be hurt. Our feelings are hurt, etc. Our intellectual aspect can be upset. We can know intellectual distress. We can be intellectually shattered. A man's brain may completely give way, you see. But the psyche cannot be killed. It's unkillable. It is extraordinarily absorptive if one sort of lives in that faith, that the psyche is unkillable. That's a fact of our existence. As long as this body is here, there is also the psyche. So don't watch in the sense of being on guard, but in the sense of being completely observant. This is the whole task. And this mindfulness includes the whole of all other aspects of meditation, the specific, profound, deep states of consciousness and everything. You see? So there we are. That is how it is. So, with regard to these dangerous sides to any sort of mental discipline, especially if it is coupled with physical discipline, the discipline of the yogic postures and breathing, which was all discovered thousands of years ago, literally thousands, at least 5,000, if not more, you see. This sensitizes us very much. Be well aware of that and act accordingly. But you can't go back. I mean, you can't say, oh, I better give it up. That's useless. You have, one has to learn through it and become adjusted to it and modify it to suit one's own organism. This is very important. For instance, in one of the disciplines, the practicer performs 100,000 prostrations. Well, you know, you can't do 100,000 prostrations starting now and finishing at the 100,000th prostration. You will be completely prostrate forever if you try that. You do it by degrees, you see, and so forth.
Perhaps
yes.
I might add something to this, which I think would be of interest. I think, as you know, Greta and I were connected with the fourth way of the Gurdjieff school for quite a long time. And we did dervish dances and movements all from East from Gurdjieff. And we did other exercises. These movements generated a terrific amount of energy because they couldn't be done unless there was a tension in. They couldn't be learned because there were different rhythms. I won't go into that, but one was always warned that this, though this collected energy, one had to keep one's attention afterwards because there were negative emotions still there, and this energy could spill out into this and cause a flare-up. And one has noticed this in other things, in meetings and that sort of thing, that one, in a way, has got to keep the attention afterwards. If it's allowed to drop, will be captured and used in a negative way, in a flare-up.
Thank you.
Could I ask a question about power focus? I think that over the years, I have personally increased in power in some way. And when I'm given power, I have a temptation to become bossy and abuse it, bossy, and, abuse the power. And I have been wondering whether one should refuse power and keep out of temptation's way, I mean, only in a small pond, obviously, or accept the power but be watchful not to abuse it, because this responsibility goes with it.
The latter is the wise thing to do. Accept the power and be very, very mindful, very watchful. You see, that it is not abused. The great question which or questions which one has to ask oneself are, have I a personal vested interest in using this power? Is it self-oriented? If it is self-oriented, then power will inevitably involve a loss to someone else if gain comes to you, or it will involve a loss to you, yourself, if it goes astray. This question of power is a very difficult question indeed, because willy-nilly, every single human being on the face of the globe is constantly exercising power, the power aspect of life, simply because things have to be done by him, which means the expenditure of force, of energy, etc., which means the utilization of power. And it's as straightforward as that. So we cannot adopt the attitude of I will refuse all power until I have developed love and wisdom in perfection and made them a harmony. You can't do it that way. All aspects of our psychical life function together, just like all the vital organs of the body function simultaneously. You see, the heart can't go on strike and say, I'm not going to work for the next 5 hours. You others can keep on working. It can't do it. You see? It will disrupt the organism. And this is what will happen psychically also. All things are present. But be aware that unless and until there is the harmony of love and wisdom, power inevitably gets misused somewhere or other. But be on the lookout for it. You see, be watchful. And as you see it going astray, so to say, then there's your opportunity to exercise self-restraint. Do nothing. But the very process of doing nothing is a very positive action, because you're doing it intelligently. You realize that this is a situation where there must not be the expenditure of energy to manifest power for the time being. When you refrain that way, that is right self-restraint. Otherwise, there is repression, which also brings an ill result. It's all very difficult, but there it is. But use the power, exercise it, and learn out of it all the time. What am I learning? You see, learn all the time. Because that which you learn, which means the extracted essence of experience, is something which is never lost. It is not lost even after we are dead, after the body is dead, for the very simple reason that this sort of these faculties, this extracted essence of life, is an influence which circulates in the world psyche. It is an energy which circulates in the world psyche. But the great thing is, look out for vested self-interest and the egoistic consequences of the use of power.
Vanity can come into it.
Hmm?
It can feed the vanity.
Exactly. Exactly. Status.
Could we investigate the selfish and the unselfish approach to religion or to the religious life? Because you mentioned this morning, I've written down a few questions. I mean,
yes, do.
You could. You do read them, perhaps one or two, I don't know.
Well, the first question is there not an impersonal search in every human being to find something which he feels missing in his life? This is the usual form in which we experience this sense of missing something. Now, first of all, we must. It is wise to approach this by asking oneself, am I trying to find something for myself or something which has universal application, which applies to all mankind? If we want to fill something which we feel is missing in our own life specifically as such, then our approach is a self-enclosed and self-enclosing approach. But if we leave it as something quite flexible, we soon discover that this which we are missing in life, as we call it, is something universal. That is to say, it is applicable to all human beings. It is the fact of transcendence being embodied in us, which in a vague way we feel. We sort of see it dimly out of the corner of our eye, and we see it in the twilight, so to start with, not in full daylight. See it in twilight, which means that we have this vague impression. And then the thing is to let that impression grow. And bit by bit, it will yield up its specific message more and more. And as it yields up its message, its universality impresses itself upon you. And then it is truly an impersonal search. But it is impersonal not in the sense of something which doesn't touch you as a personal being. It does touch the whole of you as a personal being. And since you see the relationship of the personal aspect with the same thing in everybody else around you, then it no longer is self-centered, wholly self-centered. And the self-centeredness diminishes, disappears. When you really see it, then you lose all interest insofar as loss or gain to yourself or to others is concerned. Because this feeling of, I don't want anybody else to suffer or lose something, that's also self-centered for the simple reason that we are merely identifying our little self with a larger self, the others, as we call them. It's one of the subtle little things one has to beware of, this identification with others. Self-identification with others. The next question is it selfish to try and open doors and windows that light can flow to and from, to and fro as well as air? Are you talking?
Yeah, I'm talking about oneself. I mean, all the exercises, including yoga and meditation, everything.
But
then opening doors and windows. So
you mean physical doors and windows, not mental doors?
Yeah, well, physical more than.
Why should it be selfish? Open them if you need them.
No. Because we do all the, we do meditation, we do yoga exercises, we do reading, we listen to lectures, all to expand our horizon and everything. I call that opening doors and windows. Well, this can be selfish or unselfish too. I mean, we can always do all these things with a personal goal or an impersonal one again.
I see what you mean. Well, you know, when Elohim made man in his own image and placed him in the Garden of Eden, where were the doors and windows? Man came along and enclosed himself. I think there is no question of selfishness involved in this, actually.
You spoke about the divine pulse being entombed in every human being this morning.
Yes, yes. But you are talking of doing exercises or sitting in meditation,
yes,
and opening material doors and windows.
No, not material doors. No, I mean preparing ourselves or opening the doors, I mean, which... Yes, I meant that. You know, our ignorance, getting rid of our ignorance and impurities and everything.
No, I shouldn't say that there is selfishness as such involved in it, unless one practices religious disciplines in order, either consciously or unconsciously, to obtain a specific pleasurable result for oneself.
Yes.
You see?
Well, many people do.
Yes, that is the fact. No, that has to be borne in mind. And we know how such people can make a real nuisance of themselves wherever they go. I mean, Park Place has had its... groups of people who, or at least one group of people whom we know about, who made a thorough nuisance of themselves to everybody. Now, is it selfish to want to be whole instead of a half? Again, it said as it is a question, Ingrid, it's a question of emphasis. You see, if the urge from within is, I want to be whole, and the definition of I is this particular limited self, not the total self, then of course it is selfish. But if one has grown sufficiently aware that when one says I, the real meaning of I is the totality. You see? The totality cognizing itself introduces the subjective expression of truth, of reality. The objective expression is the totality as a manifested cosmos. That's the objective expression. The subjective expression is that it is self-conscious. The Atma, that's why the word Atma is such a wonderfully useful word as used in the Upanishads and so forth. No, if one is awake to the fact that the word I is not restricted to oneself, the particular organism as such, but is in terms of the totality, the whole, the total I, then where is the selfishness involved? You see? Now, is it transcendence itself which makes us realize that we have to set off on this search without even knowing the goal? Yes, indeed. It's this mysterious influence of transcendence. There is this something else. It's a curious feeling. How remarkably we have it when we are little children. So many of us have it as children. I don't know whether all children have it, but I do know that many children do have this sense of something marvelous, something great, wonderful, all-sustaining, all-containing. And there are also children who, through the misfortune of a miserable environment, a broken up home, parents quarreling, you know, the whole story, a tragedy which is very widespread in the world, unfortunately, they, of course, don't have this feeling of this something wonderful. But they do perhaps experience very strongly the process of wishful thinking. Oh, I wish it was this, that, and the other, which would be happiness and safety and love and so on. Even that is a sort of a shadowy, ghost-like expression of the urge of transcendence, the influence of transcendence itself. Do remember that the total process is the process of transcendence coming to know itself more and more, all the time. That is the fact. It's the totality all the time. Everything interacts with everything else. And totality is not a mere collection of separate particulars which will remain everlastingly separate. The multitudinous variety of the universe, the many, constitutes the one whole, because every single thing is completely interrelated with every other single thing. That is the fact. So, this influence of the transcendent is everlastingly there. This creative pulse. You see? And when first one begins to see it as a concept, we can't avoid that. The beginning that way, you see it as a concept, an idea, a thought, and we say, oh, what a wonderful thought, what a wonderful idea, etc. But when it has become part and parcel of your natural awareness, then the wonder and the marvel is inexpressible altogether. It is truly gate gate para gate para sangate. Gone, gone, altogether, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. But in having gone altogether beyond, it is right here and now, because the here and the now, the here now, is transformed into the totality for one's own awareness. This is the great transformation. This is the realization of nirvana, the kingdom of heaven now, here. So it is transcendence itself all the time.
But Ferris, don't you get too much emphasis if you talk about the children, about the circumstances? Because it is always there, even if they are in poor condition.
I believe, even then, perhaps even more than, if you look at the countries where it's poverty, in India, see, then the great people.
Yes. It's not, Elizabeth, it's not merely poverty or difficult circumstance, but it is the crushing of the heart of the child. The living in a state of fear, of constant violence exercised upon it, physical violence, I mean, that crushes the child. You see? It's not the mere fact of poverty. No, not if the heart is crushed like that. You have damaged that child's soul sometimes irretrievably. There is no escape for it.
I just can't see that it wouldn't be open for this enormous.
If later on it happens that the circumstance changes sufficiently and changes in a manner which enables love and care and the sweetness of life to enter into that child's environment and that child's life, then there may be a healing. There could be. But you know, this doesn't happen in actual fact in thousands of cases. People are irretrievably crushed. They just never get a chance right through their lives. This is the great tragedy. Considerably helpless in several ways, and this is a cross which we have to bear for ourselves, to recognize our helplessness. We can't do anything for them or with them. You see, one must recognize one's limitations, one's inability. One can't say to oneself, oh, I am determined to bring happiness and fulfillment to these suffering people, whether they be children or whether they be adults and so forth. That very determination introduces the element of destructive conflict. One has to be extraordinarily wise and extraordinarily capable to do this. That is why, you know, some of the more serious aspects of do-gooding, I deliberately use the term do-gooding, are dangerous activities. The situation is made worse, in fact. Well, of course.
How does one, because sometimes it seems, you know, it gets to the point where it's unbearable to look and see this going on.
Don't I know that?
Yeah.
Through my own experience. Yes, that is so. But you see, here again, the best thing seems to me to be very mindful and to learn for oneself, to see and recognize one's limitations is a complete, I'll use the ordinary word, safeguard, which helps one not to go rushing about like a bull in a china shop doing the wrong thing. Otherwise, we inevitably do the wrong thing. because we can't bear it. We have to learn to bear it. Let the psyche become completely absorbent. Particularly in Mahayana, the Bodhisattva ideal, what is that? It's precisely the same as the Christian ideal of bearing the cross for the sake of all men. In the New Testament, Jesus gives his life as a ransom for the many. The Bodhisattva is already a being who is spiritually, if not actually perfect, approaching the perfection state. You see? All right. But because this infinite compassion fills him and emanates out of him, he bears the sufferings of the many and waits until their ill state, their dukkha, is, they are released from it. Until they are released from it. It's the same sort of thing. So we have to learn to look at suffering, the sufferings of others, and not rush in foolishly. It's a hard lesson to learn. We do rush in simply because we can't bear. It's an acknowledgement of defeat on our part. There is one last question here. This is a... And even if we do not... Well, I'll read it though, it's interesting. And even if we do not know the goal, do we ever know it, within brackets, we are still in a state of ignorance, but is it not transcendence again which urges us on? We never know the goal. Using the word know in the ordinary dictionary meaning of the word know, we never know it. That which we know in terms of our spiritual full human fulfillment, that which we know is something limited, something which we have to outgrow all the time. Because the goal, the source, are identical with transcendence, which is totality itself. How can totality be known as an object of knowledge? Because the moment one tries to know it as an object of knowledge, we have attempted to limit, to make small, that which is infinite. We can't do it. What does happen is that one becomes that in mind and consciousness. This is what happens. The separate, the isolative and isolated self-consciousness loses its isolativeness altogether. Its constant habit of separating things all the time. It loses that, you see. And then there is only the supreme unity present in terms of consciousness and in terms of mind. It cannot be in terms of physical manifestation, obviously, but that remains as a permanent background with you. So you have become the goal. And that, when you yourself have become that goal, you see, and are freed of the limitations of finitude, then it is transcendence in fulfillment. through you. It's a very interesting lot of questions. Then the situation is no longer one in which transcendence urges us on. We are it itself.
I wonder if I could just say something that occurs to me in about Ingrid's earlier question on selfishness and selflessness.
Mm. Yes, do.
It seems to me that quite obviously we have no possibility of altering outside events, at least directly, no possibility at all. We have no real possibility directly of altering other people. If we try, we become this do-gooder category, which is a complete mess anywhere. So the only thing we have left to work on is ourselves. This is the only possibility. Now, if this is done, as you so often suggested for us, shall I say, in an objective manner, rather like the not a very good analogy, rather like the biologist looking down a microscope at a bug. This is it. Then perhaps we can help other people in the only way that is open to us, really, or one of the most obvious ways, and that is to give room to other people where we've been crowding them with our own busy psychology. And this giving room is something very definite and very practical. It's a thing that we can all do.
Yes.
And I just thought, going on this selfishness, in a way, we only have ourselves to work on, or to be worked on.
One's own organic being, psychophysical being, is the instrument which we have to work upon, which we have to play our particular little note in the symphony of life. You see? And if one doesn't interfere with others, if one lives by letting live fully, this is just another way of saying what you were saying, you see. If we live by letting live, the very fact that we play our note as a true musical note, the influence of that is a harmonizing influence upon the one we call the other person. You see, this ties up with your question of power. But it's impossible for any living being not to exercise an influence upon his environment by the mere fact of being alive. We are constantly emanating influences out of ourselves through our ideas, our thoughts, our feelings, our speech, and our actions. You see? All these are continuously affecting the environment, affecting other people, the course of events. In that way, we are altering the world, inevitably by the mere fact of existing. So, if that is the inevitable expression of power through us as such, then the more we make our own psychophysical being harmonious, let it come to flower, to fulfillment, the greatest possible good with the least possible harm, you see, goes out into the world through us.
This possibly is when you were referring to the other group, the media, who remain nameless. And here was this misuse of power at this level. This always invariably seems to start of a certain understanding that power going into ego, I can do, and then of course I am the master dispensing. It always happens. It's very recognizable.
Bruce, will you explain this paradox of I, the artificial postulated entity you speak of, on the one hand, you see, which we know Buddhist terms, what it composes, and also on the other level you're speaking of, where we can improve the so-called I in, should I say, a mundane way. And of course, as you say, in a transcendental way. But there seems some contradiction here. I'm not quite sure where the demarcation lies. There must be a demarcation somewhere.
The living psychophysical being, which is a manifestation of the creative pulse of life, holds within it potentially the flowering out and fulfillment as the perfected holy man, holy one. You see? Now, each one of us, as we grow out of our infancy, because of the language we use and the way we regard each other, we use the word I with reference to our own organism, and we use the word you with reference to another person's organism. Now, you and I are different. We are unique insofar as the pattern manifested of our abilities, our character, our and all the rest of it has variations. And we think in terms of betterment and improvement, either in the worldly way or in the way which displays true vision. If it is in the worldly way, then it is the competitive way, the way which means I am going to be better than you, greater than you, more powerful than you, etc., etc., etc. But if there is true vision, then we see that this I, being completely interrelated with every other I, has to be wholly itself in its uniqueness, but in harmony with every other I. Therefore, Our energies are directed in this way. We know that the potentiality of this complete fruition lies within us. What is necessary is that we remove the obstacles to that potentiality. It is not that we have to develop the perfect within us, or develop transcendence within us. We have to let it work through us freely, altogether. This is our freedom. And the price we paid in the beginning of the evolution of the race, the human race, was that because of our ignorance, we lost our freedom. We had no freedom, you see. Now, if we can do this, remove the obstacles, and the removal of the obstacles, again, is the key to it is mindfulness. Because when you are really mindful and you really see, this is the obstacle. In that act of complete and total seeing, the obstacle has disappeared. The transformation of your psychical energy from an obstructing, diseased, ill pattern into a non-obstructing, healthy, mature pattern. You see, your own psyche come to full fruition, you see, that takes place naturally. And therefore, there is...
So, further then, we can say that we are, on the one hand, an artificial postulated entity, and on the other hand, the usual words, we are transcendence embodied. We're one and the same thing. Right?
True enough. Well, would you like one more question before we stop? Because 6 o'clock is your meditation meeting. Those who wish to come to it. Just one more question. No more questions? Good. Then we can all go home now. Yes, all right.
Does I exist?
Huh?
Does I exist? Does the ego exist where there is no thought? Where thought is.
What was your first word?
Does I exist? The ego exists. Where thought has stopped.
When thought has stopped. Thought as such, including ordinary discursive thought, doesn't stop. You know how Krishnamurti talks of thought. The difficulty is just this. Thought is a continuous flow expressing the fact that the psyche is alive. Just as you breathe in and you breathe out continuously, it never stops. You see, it has to go on all the time, right? Now, thought as such, therefore, never stops because it is the psyche expressing, throwing out of itself this phenomenon which we call thought. Patterns of mental energy in the form of words.
But this would include sensory perception, color.
Everything. It includes everything, you see. That never stops. What we do is to catch hold of a bit of it, so to say, and fix it. We try to fix it. Like your zoologist or entomologist is a good example. He catches hold of the poor insect or whatever it is and pins it down. It's made it a corpse. Now, it is all these corpses, these psychical corpses, with which our psychical space, our mental space is filled. And this is where the trouble comes, you see. And it is this which introduces the idea of I am I. When we say I in the ordinary way, the millions of us say I in the ordinary way, we are referring to this misconception of the reality of the living self as a fixed I, a fixation. Yes. Now, when we really awake to the true nature of the psychophysical living process, to its living process, then this false I am I, this misconception, is gone. It's a very good question.
Because one noticed this morning in the exercise we gave us, where the senses do relatively open to nature, whatever. So there's this attention. While that is held, that's the wrong way to put it, while it is there, I has no place. It isn't. It's gone.
If
then thought starts describing what has been seen, which is in the past, and I floods back, and you're
you see the reason for that. Because we cease to be totally attentive to the here now. We are now making these mental corpses, you see, trying to arrest the flow of life. Yes, Betty?
Why do we have to do that to live in the world?
Look, don't put it in that form, that we have to do that in order to live in the world. That is the way in which practically all humanity does live. That's a fact, you see. Having seen that fact and really understood it, the more we see it in its fullness and the more we understand it in completeness, the more we get released from the bondage of that fact. You see? And then you live in a totally different way. You naturally outgrow the ill state into the well state. You're released from the ill state into the well state. You see? So then there is no question after that of we have to do that in order to live. You do live in the new state. You are the new man. The transformed being. One of the meanings of the word Israel, you know, the transformed being,